Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll look at the spread of misinformation during the pandemic. Also, what are the challenges with providing mental health services in rural areas? There seems to be a growing need.
We have seen an increase in people wanting services, and I can't say for sure that it's because of the pandemic, but I do think that that's one of the reasons.
Growing up Black in rural Illinois, we'll hear from a Southern Illinois couple about their experiences. With the NFL season upon us, we'll learn more about the Quad Cities' early ties to the league. And baseball season is still going strong. We'll remember a songwriter whose legacy lives on in what has become the Chicago Cubs anthem. We'll also learn about another lesser-known sport, pigeon racing. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the spread of misinformation. How does it happen? And is it happening more during the pandemic? We'll hear a report. Cubs fans are familiar with the song Go Cubs Go. Today we'll learn about the late singer-songwriter behind the tune. And staying on sports, we'll find out more about the Quad Cities' role in the early days of the NFL. That and more this hour on Statewide. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought about many changes to the way healthcare is provided, and that includes mental health. In some rural areas, the shift to providing counseling services online has created both challenges and opportunities. To learn more, Christine Herman spoke with Laura Lynn Kropak, who leads the Community Resource Counseling Center in Paxton in eastern Illinois. They began by discussing the challenges unique to rural areas when it comes to accessing mental health services.
I'm speaking very broadly here, but I think there is a very strong sense of independence in rural areas and people, kind of being used to sort of taking care of themselves, taking care of their own business. So there can be a high degree of stigma. Also, it's hard to be anonymous. You know, we talk about privacy and confidentiality, and we certainly do everything we can, you know, to honor that. But you know, the truth is, everybody knows what kind of car I drive, or they recognize my license plate, you know? And so if you want a lot of privacy, you know, sometimes that can be hard to come by. Or your prescription, you know, gets filled at the same drugstore the rest of the town goes to. So that can pose a barrier for people, although I actually tend to think that once they've gotten started, that kind of fades away some. Also, the transportation, the shape of Ford County is such that if you live in the northern part of the county, it may take you 40 minutes to get here if you're driving.
You know, we hear a lot about the mental health toll of the COVID-19 pandemic, and nationally we've been seeing suicide rates rising. Have you seen an increased need for services in Ford County due to the pandemic?
We have seen an increase in people wanting services, and I can't say for sure that it's because of the pandemic, but I do think that that's one of the reasons. What we have noticed is that a person who had a little bit of a problem with anxiety before may have much more of a problem with anxiety now. Same with depression. In general, for someone who has mental health concerns, you know, it's not what we would usually recommend, you know, to keep themselves locked up at home and not to go out, in the community. And the circumstances of the pandemic are kind of counterproductive to good mental health in many cases.
And how has it been going having to shift to doing more teletherapy and providing services online more so than in person?
When the pandemic first started, we gave staff the option of working from home. And we were really fortunate with the timing in terms of the ways we had upgraded our system here. I mean, like 2 weeks before, we had just installed a new server that made it possible for our staff to port in to our client data system from home. And that was huge. So most of our staff decided to work from home. So everything was by phone and by video. to my surprise, we actually found that there were many clients who really enjoyed phone and video sessions. Some of them prefer it.
And speaking of access, I mean, the other side of the coin with teletherapy, have there been challenges when it comes to rural broadband issues and people not having internet access? Is that something playing out for some of your clients?
We do have clients that don't have a good signal at all. Now, a lot of those people, though, will just choose to use their phone. The therapist part of me can struggle with that a little bit because you lose a lot of information when you can't see someone's face, you know, or can't see how their body is moving or that kind of thing. But it still has been a method that has made it more possible to communicate with people.
That's Laura Lynn Kropek, who heads the Community Resource Counseling Center in Paxton. She spoke with Christine Herman. Misinformation about COVID-19 has spread almost as much as the disease itself, and sometimes faster. Why is this the case? Chase Kavanaugh tells us more in this report.
When it emerged earlier this year, the world had limited knowledge of the coronavirus and its full effects. Doctors and researchers worked to better understand the disease, but countless rumors also circulated. Peter Adams with the News Literacy Project explains.
Like self-test, you know, if you can hold your breath for 10 seconds, you don't have it, and that's entirely false. Or, you know, if you gargle with water, you can wash the virus out of your throat. That's false. So those kinds of false claims circulated quite a bit.
These small claims can escalate to much larger concerns when somebody gets sick, including how they seek treatment. That's what Dr. Brian Pastinchian, hospitalist medical director at Delmar Hospital, is seeing.
Some people who are waiting and delaying routine care or even urgent care are presenting with more advanced problems that perhaps may have normally been the case pre-COVID.
Expert information on COVID-19 may appear sporadic and contradictory. This, says Pastinchian, is a factor of time.
Typically, you've got months to years to gather data. And, you know, with COVID, you've kind of been operating on a much, much smaller time frame to determine what's best, what works for patients, you know, what may not be as effective.
Confusion can also come from a misunderstanding of how scientific research is done. Nicole Ledoux is a professor at Northern Illinois University whose work includes training future science teachers. She says issues can arise when people are presented with news reports of studies that contradict each other.
When there's new findings, that is often picked up because it's exciting. But in the scientific community, you would find that if there's one finding that's quite unusual, that the rest of the scientific community would be pretty skeptical of that finding.
Ledoux emphasizes that science is an iterative process. Skepticism, in this case, prompts further study.
They might change a particular variable, and they might find, you know, that finding, while it was true, when we put it in this new context, we find out more information that contextualizes that first finding.
But even with a proper understanding of research, there's still the matter of people trusting the information that they find. Adams with the News Literacy Project says over the past decade, people have been consuming a greater proportion of opinion content.
That has caused people to just echo the talking points that they're hearing all day, every day, and people are really failing to distinguish between opinion journalism and straight news reporting.
That's not to say opinion journalism doesn't have a role.
People who know subjects very well, who engage in honest debate, who, you know, take positions that are well-reasoned and thoughtful, that plays a role in the national conversation, but we still need a shared set of facts about which to have a debate.
Ledoux says this should also be taken into account when judging suggested courses of action regarding COVID-19.
There are a lot of economic consequences and personal consequences to following the guidelines presented by scientists. And when we group those things together, that makes people point to the scientists as they're the problem. They're not the problem. The data is the data. What we choose to do with that data is a different question.
Ultimately, a large part of combating disinformation comes down to distinguishing opinion versus fact. Ledoux says this can depend on the nature of the research behind a report.
I look at who has done the study. Is that study funded by a company that's profiting off of the result? I look at, did that finding have a control group or a comparison group? So did they vary a variable?
And how information is presented.
Trustworthy information doesn't actually ask you to trust it. It shows you why you should.
Pastinchian at Northwestern Medicine says patient knowledge is improving.
Unfortunately, sometimes people just don't know how they were exposed or when they may have acquired it from. But we've seen variant spectrums, you know, from very little knowledge of anything about COVID-19 to kind of people who really do a good job reading up on it.
And the hope is that greater scientific and media literacy can help fight the flow of misinformation. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
Governor J.B. Pritzker says the state is working on a distribution plan for a COVID vaccine, even though there's no clear timeline for when one will be ready. The governor says the state would distribute the vaccine based on availability and priority.
We want to make sure that the people who are most vulnerable are reached first. People who are most at risk because of the jobs that they have, our frontline workers, our nurses, our doctors, etc. We want to make sure that they are covered.
As for suggestions a vaccine could be ready by the 1st of November, the governor says that claim is coming from someone who's running for re-election, a reference to President Donald Trump. As the NFL season kicks off once again, let's take a look back at the early days of the league, very early. Herb Trix spoke with Don Doxey. He's a sports reporter for the Quad Cities Time and Dispatch Argus. Doxey has written about the Quad Cities' ties to the beginnings of the NFL.
Remind us, Don, when and where did professional football begin?
Well, I mean, professional football was played off and on probably back into the 19th century, but the NFL, the main primary football league that we all know and love, began in 1920. It was founded by a group of people really in Canton, Ohio, but the Rock Island Independents were part of that group. They were one of the founding members.
Okay, so the first people that talked about it seriously were in Canton, and that's why the Hall of Fame is located there?
Absolutely, yeah. It actually began with a meeting of people just from a couple of Ohio teams in August of 1920, and then about a month later in September, they brought in other people, mostly from around the Midwest, and Ralph Hay was a Hupmobile dealer. We don't know Hupmobiles now, but it was apparently a popular car in 1920. Mm-hmm. They met in his showroom in Canton, Ohio, and put together this league. And, of course, it's with us still today.
We say here, anyway, that the Quad Cities hosted the first game, but isn't there some controversy about that?
Well, I think it's the first game played by one of the teams in the league. They played, the Rock Island Independents played the St. Paul Ideals, who were not a member of the league, but so it was more or less an exhibition game. But most people generally consider that to be the first NFL game. I'm not sure exactly when the first game between two members of the league was. That would have been probably a week or so later, but that game between the Independents and the St. Paul Ideals, most people anyway, consider to be the first NFL game.
Okay, so remind us, Don, how different was football in 1920 versus today? Would we recognize it?
Probably not. The players didn't wear a lot of pads. Many of them didn't wear helmets. Believe it or not, it was into the 1940s before they were required to wear helmets. There's very little passing. The rules really strongly discourage passing. In fact, there are just so many different rule changes that were different. Substitutions were different. You couldn't run players in and out. If you took a player out in the first quarter, he was done until halftime. He couldn't go back in. So there was also the ball was bigger and much more difficult to throw. It was rounded on the end. It looked almost like a watermelon rather than the ball we know today. So
it sounds a little bit like rugby.
Actually, yes. I mean, it was actually derived from rugby in a way. And you're right. It much more resembled rugby than what we know today as football.
And what about the dropkick, Don? It just occurred to me that's one of the things we did as kids, but it's not a part of the NFL.
It was a part of the NFL, but it's not something that they used very often. I suspect that the shape and the size of the ball probably made it fairly difficult, but it was part of the game.
Now, one of the early professional players from this area was a guy named Duke Slater, and tell us about him.
Duke grew up in Clinton, Iowa, and played at the University of Iowa and was really a pioneer because he was black. He was the very first black lineman in the NFL, and for quite a few years in the late 20s, he was the only black player in the NFL. Very much a pioneer in that way. Was elected to the Pro Football Hall of Fame finally this year, and of course the induction ceremonies won't be held now until next year because of COVID-19, but had a tremendous career after football as a a lawyer, and then a circuit court judge in Chicago. So very fondly remembered at Iowa, but, also had a great career in the NFL.
Now, recently, Don, you listed 100 connections to the NFL with the Quad Cities, and we've talked about a couple of them already. I don't guess you just reeled them off the top of your head. How did you find them all?
No, actually, a lot of the research for this was done at the end of the millennium. I poured through records back then to make a list of all of the players who'd ever played in the NFL from here. It's something else I've written about and researched periodically through the years. So I really just kind of, for the 100th anniversary of the league, really pulled a lot of that old research and everything that I'd done and kind of pulled it together into one package.
So what do? Do you just put in your search terms Moline NFL and names pop up?
There's a great website called profootballreference.com it has a great search engine. You can go in there and find everybody who ever played in the NFL, who attended Moline High School, who was, and I think over the years I've probably put in every little town in this area and every high school and every college. And, it's a lot of legwork to get little bits and pieces, but, in the end, to be able to put together something like this, it's worth it.
That's Herb Trick speaking with sports reporter Don Doxey of the Quad City Times and Dispatch Argus about the early years of the NFL in the Quad Cities. By the way, Illinois was well represented that first season back in 1920 with two teams in Chicago and another in Decatur, the Staleys, coached by George Halas, who soon moved the team to Chicago and it became the Bears. Still to come on Statewide, we'll look back at the life and career of a singer-songwriter, Steve Goodman, a Chicago original. This is Statewide. Despite the pandemic, Major League Baseball is playing a season, even though fans aren't in the ballparks. At Wrigley Field in Chicago, while there are no fans, what has become the team's anthem is still being played following victories. Member station WBEZ produces a podcast called Curious City, where listeners ask questions and reporters seek out the answers. This week on Statewide, we're able to bring you an episode that features reporter Jesse Dukes along with Alexandra Salomon. It focuses on that Cub anthem and the songwriter, both of which are pure Chicago.
Okay, Alex, I'd like to start us off with some sound.
Go Cubs go! Go Cubs go! Okay, Jesse, I hear it.
So, you can pause it.
Pause it.
Do you recognize this sound?
Yes, that is the song. They sing at Cubs games, and I believe you have to win, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
Yep, you're absolutely right. It's Go Cubs Go, and they play it over the public address system at Wrigley Field if the Cubs win a home game. So it's this Chicago tradition. But there's actually a little bit of a dilemma. It was actually spotted by our question asker, Nick Bruner, and he noticed something in the third verse of the song. Which many people don't even know, but it goes...
Baseball time is here again. You can catch it all on WGN.
Alex, did you catch the problem?
I know that WGN doesn't broadcast the baseball games anymore.
Yeah, you got it. Exactly. The problematic line is you can catch it all on WGN. Which is not true anymore, and in fact, the Cubs haven't been on WGN radio for a few years now, but WGN TV has been their broadcast home for decades, and that is no longer true as of this year, because the Cubs are launching their own network, Marquee Sports Network, and you know, the Cubs probably don't want to promote a rival broadcaster in their own stadium. So Nick, our question asker, wanted to know, what are the Cubs going to do about that?
Get a super fan to write a new lyric?
So you could get a super fan maybe to write another song or rewrite the song, but you could not get the original songwriter to rewrite it, who is Steve Goodman. So here's his story. Steve Goodman was born in 1948, grew up on the north side of Chicago, and his biographer, Clay Eel, says he was a Cubs fan from the beginning.
His dad would take him to Wrigley. He would skip school to go see the Cubs. And you got to understand, this was a time when the Cubs were not drawing very many people. They never won.
This was peak lovable losers Cubs. And in fact, I just looked this up. He was born in 1948. The Cubs did not have a winning season until 1963.
Wow.
So until he was 15 years old, he never saw them have a winning season.
Yeah.
Steve started getting into music when he was pretty young. He sang in the choir at his temple.
He was a boy soprano.
He played guitar in a kind of high school folk band.
You never, in high school, never saw him without a guitar.
Went off to college.
But didn't last there very long because he didn't like to go to class. He would rather play his guitar.
And right around this time, he's 20 years old. He is not feeling very well. He goes to the hospital, and he is diagnosed at age 20 with acute lymphoblastic leukemia.
Oh, gosh. Am I going to like this story, Jesse? I hope.
It has its ups and downs.
Yeah.
That is a very scary diagnosis. The prognosis for people who got diagnosed back then was maybe 6 months. You know, there wasn't really an effective treatment.
Yeah, and he's so young.
Yeah, he's 20. And really, like, friends and family thought he was probably going to die. But they were just starting to develop these new cancer treatments, and he signed up for an experimental treatment. And after several months of that, the cancer actually goes into a remission in the summer of 1969. And that's really when he decides he's done with college and he's just going to focus on being a full-time folk musician.
You know, we all get these little signals in our life. It's sort of like being at a light, and the light either turns red or it turns green. Mm-hmm. You know, just have to wait for the light sometimes.
Pretty quickly, he could make a living just playing songs, singing songs in a handful of bars around Chicago. There were all these clubs, and they were really just kind of like bars, like places where, you know, maybe you could get 50, 60, 70 chairs. You know, there was the Earl of Old Town, which kind of became his home.
Our own Steve Goodman!
Some performers would just get up and sing their songs. Steve would do that. He was a virtuoso guitar player, but he also was a storyteller.
Wrote this song after I walked to the bottom of the Grand Canyon in 1975. Just got back.
He talked about the Cubs a lot and how terribly they were doing. That was kind of a theme.
The Cubs, now they haven't won during my lifetime, and I'm not that young.
He just charmed everybody.
Good night. Thank you very much.
Okay, so, you know, by the early 1980s, Steve is making his living as a folk singer, as a musician, and he's pretty successful. You know, he has a record deal, certainly has the respect of his peers, and he's lived, you know, 10 years longer than the original doctors would have predicted. You know, he's in his early 30s, but he still has two goals. There's still things that are eluding him. And one is that he's never had a hit song on the charts where he's the performer and the singer. Other people have recorded songs he wrote and had hits, you know, maybe most notably
on the city
Arlo Guthrie, the son of Woody Guthrie, had a number 4 easy listening hit with the city of New Orleans. The country singer David Allan Coe had a country hit with You Never Even Called Me By My Name. It kind of makes fun of country, but it made it onto the country music charts.
Well, a friend of mine named Steve Goodman wrote that song, and he told me it was the perfect country and western song.
But he was never the singer on those hits up to that point, and, you know, it's clear that he may have been a little frustrated about that.
Why didn't he have a hit?
Well, there are a lot of possible reasons, but his biographer Clay Eels has a theory. And this is kind of a famous story. Back in the 1970s, he was discovered by the country singer Kris Kristofferson.
Goodman was being handed the brass ring. You know, would you like to come to New York to start a recording contract? Most anybody in that circumstance would say, gee, yes, thank you. But the first thing out of Goodman's mouth was, well, if you think I'm good, you got to hear my friend John Prine.
He had this instinct towards generosity, and I'm not sure that always worked in his favor.
That kind of generosity is more of a great life lesson, but it doesn't necessarily translate into becoming the household word, you know?
Yeah, he was too nice a guy.
Yeah, maybe he was just too nice to have a hit. So that was goal number one. And moving on to goal number two, remember, Steve loved baseball.
I've been trying to write a song about baseball for 4 years, and I get about 3/4 of the way through it, and then I walk somebody and take myself out, you know? I never get to finish the damn thing.
It's a baseball metaphor. You know, it basically means failure.
It's true. I get about 3/4 of the way through it, and then I'm struggling. You know, it's a hot afternoon, and I'm looking to the bench, and the manager comes out and yanks me.
So he's been trying to write a baseball song for years, and finally, in 1981, he wakes up in the middle of the night with this vision, this dream, and from that comes a song called A Dying Cub Fan's Last Request.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan.
What you're seeing is a video of Steve playing the song live.
An old Cub fan lay dying.
He's up on a rooftop with his guitar. He's got a bright blue Cubs hat on. You can see Wrigley Field in the background. You can even see the infield grass, nice and green.
They knew his time was short.
It's about this lifelong Cubs fan who is dying.
He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest.
And he's telling his friends and family how he wants to go.
He said, give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day.
And the song also really makes fun of the Cubs for losing all the time.
But what do you expect when you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush them like so many paper beer cups? Year after year after year. After year after year after year after year after year. Until those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat. He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore.
That's intense, actually.
What's intense about it?
Now that I know about his diagnosis, it feels like it's autobiographical and that he's talking about his death.
Yeah, it does. It sounds that way. But, you know, when he wrote the song, he was in remission. He had been more or less cancer-free for 12 years. But between the time he wrote the song and this video was shot, the cancer had returned.
When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy. Now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, and the doormat of the National League.
So that was Steve's first baseball song, and pretty quickly it becomes a crowd pleaser at his shows and kind of a local favorite in Chicago. And in fact, the local TV station wants to film him performing it at Wrigley Field, but the Cubs wouldn't allow it. The reason was the song pokes fun at their propensity to lose, and they didn't like that. And this was a time when they were trying to rebuild a team and they were focusing on winning, and they just didn't want that lovable loser's crap in their stadium. So, this is where Dan Fabian comes into the story.
Talking into the receiver.
Dan Fabian was a radio producer at WGN.
Yeah, radio.
And one time while he was at work, he saw Steve Goodman on the radio, you know, like doing an interview or performance.
And man, the light bulb went on.
Fabian had been looking for some bumper music for the WGN Cubs broadcasts, like stuff to play in between the innings. And so he saw Steve Goodman there, and he had this idea. What if Steve Goodman writes a song?
So anyhow, I literally ran to the studio, scribbled a little note, went in and slipped it to him during a commercial.
Hey, do you want to write another Cubs song? I like Dying Cubs fans' last request. Would you like to write a happy Cubs song?
That was on a Tuesday. He came back Thursday with a guitar and with the bones of the song. And the following Monday night, Tuesday morning, we had a party at a little studio just south of Wrigley.
Goodman just like rounds up a bunch of his folk singing friends.
I think a couple of the Cubs were actually part of it too.
Baseball season's underway.
And they just knocked the song out.
And what was your involvement with the recording? Were you producing?
I'll have you know I'm the high squeaky voice in the background.
Oh, you sang?
I told you it was a party.
Go Cubs, go! Go Cubs, go! Hey, Chicago!
Anyhow, we recorded it, and 3 weeks later, it was on the air.
And the Cubs liked it. And this year, the Cubs, this is 1984, they're actually doing really, really well that year. And they say, you know what, if we make it to the playoffs, Steve Goodman can come and sing the Star Spangled Banner. He's not going to sing the Dying Cubs fan song, but we'll let Steve Goodman come and sing, you know, to kick off the game, because we love this song. And the Cubs actually do make it to the playoffs for the first time since 1945. But Steve Goodman dies of leukemia 4 days before that. But that's actually not the end of the story. So you remember I told you he wanted to write a great baseball song, and, you know, arguably he wrote two. Do you remember his other big goal?
He wanted to have a song that he wrote himself, that he performed, that would be a hit.
Exactly. That song, Go Cubs Go, was used by WGN for a few years, but then it kind of got forgotten.
Mm.
You know, you were talking about the Cubs playing it at the end of every game. That's a relatively recent tradition. That started in 2007, which was also a big year for the Cubs. Somebody at the Cubs organization said, hey, remember that old song from the 80s, Steve Goodman, all that? Why don't we dust that off and play it after a home game win, and we'll see if people sing along. And
they did.
They sang along. It caught on. It became this big tradition at Wrigley Field. It also caught on in the bars. You know, people would sing along. And then in 2016,
here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series. Bryant makes the play.
Go Cubs Go got a lot of attention. Bill Murray and a couple of the Cubs sang the song on Saturday Night Live. The cast of Hamilton in Chicago sang it, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were singing it in Grant Park at the Victory Parade. There were something like 2 million streams on Spotify, and it went up on the Billboard charts.
Wow, and that's like, what, 30 years later, he finally gets a hit that he sang.
And, you know, Steve Goodman fans would say it's kind of ironic, because Go Cubs Go is not what they would consider to be one of his best songs. But Clay Eales and others say Goodman would have appreciated the situation. And yeah, it's sad that he didn't live to see it. But if you think about it, it's also kind of the perfect story for this song. Because, you know, for most of Steve's life, the notion that the Cubs are going to win, baseball season's here again, you know, it's time to start a whole new day. All of these lines are about optimism in spite of all the available evidence. And I think that resonates deeply with Chicago Cubs fans. And I think that, sorry, I'm getting emotional. I think it's also, even though it's a pretty simple song, it is also kind of the essence of Steve Goodman. And I think, you know, in that clip I played for you, and you see all those people singing the song, you know, full-throatedly, and they've got signs that say, this is for Grandpa. I think Steve tapped into that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think there is that dream that somehow they'll succeed someday, and people not giving up on that dream. I do think it's real, and I think it's kind of like the spirit of the city a little bit. Chicago, we're not New York, but we're going to matter too.
So maybe, you know, you could see why it might be a little bit difficult for the Cubs to think about rewriting or reperforming
yes.
the song.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I see why now it's not such a simple thing. So what are the Cubs doing?
Well, they have said they're going to continue the tradition. But according to Clay Eales, Steve Goodman's biographer, it doesn't actually matter what the Cubs do.
The song is going to survive any ownership change, any radio change.
Because the fans will be singing the song no matter what.
I mean, Go Cubs Go, I think, is forever.
Thanks to reporter Jesse Dukes and Alexandra Salomon of WBEC. Their episode for their Curious City podcast was produced by Stephen Jackson and Linnea Dominic, and they shared it with us here on Statewide. Stay with us. There's more to come. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Pigeon racing, it's not as popular as it used to be, but some are still keeping the sport alive, and we'll hear more about that ahead. Harold Bardot grew up in Sparta, Illinois, and he later moved to Carbondale, working at Southern Illinois University in several different roles. Last year, StoryCorps came to Carbondale to speak with Southern Illinoisans about their lives. Harold and his wife, Lana, talked about growing up in rural Illinois as African Americans at a time when segregation still ruled much of America.
In our neighborhood, there were not many people that had automobiles, but every once in a while on the street, you would see this black Ford sedan parked outside someone's home. Do you remember seeing that in the neighborhood?
Not really, not to pay a lot of attention to it. I had older people in my house when I was very young. They were great grandparents and et cetera, and they were ill. So the doctor came to our house. One of them was blind, and the other one had kidney problems. And I never noticed there being a difference except for when they were at my house.
So the way we knew that someone was sick in the neighborhood, since I'm a bit older than you are, was to see this black Ford sedan outside people's homes. And we knew that was Dr. Boynton's car. So we knew that someone in the house had to be sick, and almost gravely sick, because at that time, I don't recall people going to see a physician or a doctor unless they were really, really sick. We grew up in a small town of Sparta, Illinois. There were only about 3,200 people that lived there. So we had three doctors for about a population of maybe, the sign outside Sparta used to say, 3,200 people. Of course, that was in 1939, 1940. And so that was my experience with a doctor. I don't ever recall having gone to see a doctor except one time, and I went to see Dr. Fullerton to get a shot because I had a cold, and the coach took me, basketball coach took me to see the doctor because he thought the shot might help me so that I would be able to play basketball. What do you recall about going to see doctors?
I saw a doctor regularly. My grandfather owned a local juke joint or whatever. And he was very much into seeing to it that my health was good. So I saw a dentist once a year, eye doctor once a year. If I got sick, the doctor came to the house. But like I said, he came regularly anyway up until the time that those two older people in the family died. And so if there was a problem that I was having, then he'd take care of that too. I don't remember going to the doctor outside of the home. Except once, in the middle of the night, I got sick and they thought I had appendicitis and they took me to the emergency room at the hospital. Mm. But that's the only time I remember actually going out to see a doctor.
I never had a person of color as a physician until years later in my life when we moved back here to Carbondale in 1968. So my first African-American physician was an ophthalmologist, Dr. Jackson. When was your first experience with an African-American physician?
Well, part of my family is from Birmingham, Alabama. Back in the 60s, it was segregated to the point, which I thought was great. Looking back, I guess it wasn't, but when I was a kid, I thought it was great. And I got some kind of bug or something, and I went to see a black doctor when I was there. but that's the only ones you could see. I mean, you didn't have a choice. That you saw a black doctor, you didn't see anyone.
Did you feel, you said you went to see a doctor in Sparta when we were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about that encounter with that physician? Did you feel any different from seeing a person of color or not? Or do you recall?
I don't recall that there was any difference. These in Sparta, when we grew up, there was no quote-unquote totally black neighborhood or totally white. Well, there were some totally white neighborhoods, but they were out and away from the places that I frequented anyway. And so it never entered my mind as a kid.
This story was produced by Steph Whiteside with interviews recorded by StoryCorps, a national nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories in order to build connections between people and create a more just and compassionate world. Find out more about StoryCorps at StoryCorps.org.
The U.S. relies on migrant and seasonal farm workers, some of whom travel from place to place to cultivate and harvest crops. Outbreaks of COVID-19 on farms have killed more than a dozen farm workers and infected thousands more. While employers are not required to test workers for COVID-19, federally funded migrant clinics have partnered with the state to provide testing through mobile health units. The Community Health Partnership of Illinois operates migrant clinics at several locations in central and northern Illinois. Christine Herman spoke with the partnership's CEO, Elise Sawyers, about how testing efforts are going.
We continue to test as much as we are able to. Sometimes we do have on a schedule locations that we need to visit, and then things change. Right now, we have a shortage of outreach teams, so we have a challenge of human resource shortage as well. So we're doing the best that we can in the community. I think we're over 1,600 in terms of tests right now. Depending on the location, sometimes the positive rate is zero, sometimes 4%. But our average on the 1,600 tests that we've done so far is about 14%.
Are you mostly going to showing up at hotels where workers are staying and showing up near migrant camps? Or are you also trying to coordinate with growers to come to the field sites where the workers are working?
We target everywhere our farm workers are. So we try our best to identify when they're coming in, where they're housed, where they work. We try to develop relationship with the workers, the growers, the plants. So depending on where they give us permission, we're constantly always asking and letting them know, the owners and growers and employers, that we're here. We provide now the COVID testing. So where we have success, we take them. And we try to also make sure the messaging go out, the successes that we're having, so they will also join on as well.
And when you say that there's been a bit of a staffing shortage, is that because were you trying to ramp up and do even more outreach than usual because of the pandemic and the elevated need for these types of services for farm workers?
Absolutely. So we are funded by the federal government. Quite a few dollars came down the pipeline to do testing. We accepted those dollars and we're trying to make sure we hire quickly. So there's a lot of challenges. Can you get the staff in as quickly as you get the dollars in to hire? Can you get to the location? Can you get the numbers of locations? Can you get the information as to where your H2As and your other migrant farm workers are? Can you get access to do the testing? We learn of COVID-19 or more of it within the last 6 months. How long does it take to even hire the staffing that you need to get the numbers of staff out there? So we've been really working collaboratively with state agencies. We're looking at funding sources everywhere. We're seeking volunteers as well. We're looking at health departments that we can partner with. And then you have the challenge of even over staff. There is a fear going out there to test. And then we also have the shortage of staff when we pull from our clinics to go into the community to test. So it's a whole planning focus and with challenges.
Do you wish that the testing was mandated for farm workers, that it was required that employers provide it?
So, you know, that's a beautiful thing. We've had that conversation. We think it is a good thing to test before entry, right? That's a preventive measure in itself. Absolutely. So as much as the state requirements and the guidance will be moving forward, I'm on many committees having the conversation, but I think it is the right thing to do.
That's Elise Sawyer, CEO of the Community Health Partnership of Illinois. She spoke with Christine Herman. Bradley University has imposed an all-student quarantine for the next 2 weeks to limit COVID-19 exposure. About 50 students there have tested positive so far. Another 500 are self-isolating after contacts with an infected person. University spokesperson Renee Charles says that was not the reason for the decision.
It wasn't that we hit a certain number of positive tests or a certain number of quarantine. It's just that exponential continued growth that we had to say, okay, we need to stop, we need to pause, and we need to reset our action.
Students at Bradley will learn remotely for the next 2 weeks. Charles says the goal is to increase good practices, get everyone on the same page, then go back to in-person classes for the rest of the semester. You're listening to Statewide. A small group of dedicated enthusiasts has been racing pigeons in St. Louis for the past century. And as Shayla Farzon reports, the club is trying to keep the sport alive and maintain its close-knit community.
Charlie Klipsch pulls his silver minivan into a parking lot along Interstate 44 in St. Clair, Missouri. He pops open his trunk, revealing 25 pigeons peering back at him from inside two cages. These aren't your typical city birds. They're homing pigeons with an uncanny ability to navigate hundreds of miles back home. Klipsch lifts the cages from his trunk and sets them on the ground.
All right, we're going to do it on three. One, two, three.
The pigeons burst through the open door in a blur of wings. They circle for a minute and then move together as a flock. They're headed back to Klipsch's house, 40 miles away in Sunset Hills.
They got a little bit of a east-southeast wind, so they're going to be a little bit faster than they normally would, which means that we got to travel a little faster than we normally would.
He hops into his van and peels out of the parking lot, trying to beat the birds home. From the driver's seat, he says he's training them, gradually increasing the distance of the releases to build up their endurance.
They got to train to get their respiratory system working. They got to train to get their muscle system working. You know, it's like any athlete. They're athletes of the sky.
Klipsch is a third-generation pigeon racer and a member of the Mount Pleasant Homing Pigeon Club, a group that's been racing these birds in St. Louis since the 1920s. On a muggy August evening, half a dozen members gather at their clubhouse, a small brick garage in South City. Its walls are covered in paintings of past champion pigeons done by the members themselves. Tonight, they're bringing their pigeons to prep for the first race of the season. Each bird has a plastic band on its leg with a tiny chip inside. Klipsch holds the pigeons up to an electronic reader, like scanning a candy bar at the grocery store.
This registers the band number 302, and we're checking that. That's 302. He's ready to go in a race.
In less than an hour, they've registered all 49 pigeons for the race and tucked them into specially designed steel cages, outfitted with food and water troughs.
That's it. All in.
Outside, Jason Sadorf is just pulling up in his truck. He's in charge of driving the birds about 150 miles away to Lebanon, Missouri. He'll release them early the next morning by pulling a lever that opens all of the cage doors simultaneously.
You can actually stand up to about 10 feet away from the trailer, and you can feel the wind and the movement from the birds flying out of the trailer. It's almost like a helicopter taking off. You can feel the downforce from all the birds flapping and wanting to fly.
The birds will all fly back to their individual homes, where they'll be scanned to make note of their exact arrival time. That way, the racers can figure out which pigeons flew the fastest. Club member Kevin Sweeney says this group is passionate about pigeons, but there's more to it than that. They're friends who like to spend time together, even if they sometimes disagree.
Like anything else, you're going to get political differences, and if you ask five different pigeon flyers an opinion about something, you're going to get five answers. It's just the way it is.
For many of these racers, this has been a Saturday night tradition since they were kids, when their parents got together to race. But the size of this club has dwindled in recent years, and members say they're worried that someday soon it might disappear altogether.
Silly to let a club like this go downhill because everybody's getting older. Young people just don't know about it.
Roy Wolf lives in Eureka and just joined the club this spring. He's bred show rabbits for the past 45 years, but he says he's always wanted to have pigeons. For him, there's something alluring about the idea of turning a bird loose and having it come home to you. Wolf says most people don't understand how special these animals are.
They think they're flying rats. They don't realize that the homing pigeon is completely different than the wild pigeon. I mean, day and night difference.
His grandkids, he says, have already asked if they can start raising pigeons with him. I'm Shayla Farzon.
Well, it's time for us to fly here on Statewide. We'll be back next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode, you can find it and all our past shows at statewideshow.com. You can get our podcast through the NPR One app, and Statewide is Statewide. Our website lists the stations that carry us each week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.